Hi everyone, I think we'll get started given it's 3:30. So welcome to this special Women in Economics session of the Conference of Economists. My name is Danielle Wood. I am a fellow at the Grattan Institute, and also probably more relevant for this session, I'm one of the co-founders and the national chair of the Women in Economics Network. The Women in Economics Network is hosting this session. For those of you that don't know, we launched the network in March of this year. We're part of the Economic Society of Australia, and our objective is really to promote and support women in the economics discipline. So I'm going to say a little bit more about the network towards the end, but we are hoping to make a Women in Economics session an annual fixture at the Conference of Economists. And since this is our very first year, we thought we would start with a broad panel discussion about gender diversity in the economics profession. So I've somewhat provocatively titled this session, Does Gender Balance in Economics Matter? I think as economists, we should always, particularly economists if we're proposing to take interventions, we should always start with the threshold question of what we're trying to achieve and whether that's a valid goal. Certainly in my mind, I answer that question in the affirmative, but we have a panel here today to discuss it from a really diverse range of backgrounds, but all very much at the top of their fields. So I will now introduce our illustrious panel. Starting on our far right is Alexandra Heath. She is currently the head of the Economic Analysis Department at the Reserve Bank of Australia. She spent most of her career at the Reserve Bank in the Economic and Financial Markets Group, as well as several years at the Bank for International Settlements. She's got a PhD from the London School of Economics, and she completed her honours undergraduate degree in economics from the University of Sydney. We've got Leith next. Leith is not a token at all.
I did ask to be introduced that way.
Leith is a fantastically enthusiastic economics HSIE teacher at Burwood Girls High School. She completed a Bachelor of Economics at the University of Sydney and began her career as a marketing rep for IBM. She went on to do a postgraduate diploma in education. She worked as a casual teacher for a number of years before finding her spiritual home at Burwood Girls High School, which is a comprehensive public school that shares her commitment to empowering female students. Since she's been there, there's been a very large expansion in their economics, the number of students taking on economics. And she's also received the Premier's RBA scholarship, which she's using to study gender disparities in economics education. Now for our token male, Matthew Butland. Matt is currently Victoria's Red Tape Commissioner. He's also been the chair of the Victorian Competition and Efficiency Commission. He's been a Productivity Commission Commissioner and has had senior executive roles in mining, management consulting and several Commonwealth departments. He's also currently the president of the Economic Society of Australia and has been a fantastic supporter of the Women in Economics Network. Deborah Cobb-Clark is a professor of economics at the University of Sydney. She is a director of the program in Gender and Families at the Institute for the Study of Labour in Bonn, Germany. She's a chief investigator at the ARC Centre for Excellence for Children and Families over the Life Course and an elected fellow of the Academy of Social Science. Deborah has a PhD in economics from the University of Michigan. Prior to her current role at University of Sydney, she was the head of the Melbourne Institute. She's also held positions in the US Labor Department, Illinois State University, and the ANU, where she was the founding director of the Social Policy Evaluation, Analysis and Research Center. Finally, we have Sherelle Murphy. Sherelle is a member of the ANZ research team. She, prior to that role, she worked ANZ Corporate Communications, including the position of Senior Manager of Media Relations. She's also been a journalist for the Australian Financial Review, including as economics correspondent for the paper in the Federal Parliamentary Press Gallery. So if you could all join me in welcoming our fantastic panel. Sorry, that was a bit of a mouthful. So the question I wanted to start with for the panel, and the way we're going to run this session, is we'll do sort of a panel Q&A for around 45 minutes or so, and then we'll open it up for questions from the audience. But I wanted to actually pose the question on the first slide there to everyone on the panel. Do you think gender balance in economics matters, and why? So perhaps we'll start with you, Alex.
Sure. I think my perspective on this panel comes from as a macroeconomic policymaker, and I think we would be crazy not to think diversity of thought in the process of putting together policy mattered. And gender is one of the dimensions of diversity that's going to help us to make sure that we have conversations where we... I mean, economics at some level gives us a framework to discuss a whole range of issues that don't have definitive answers. And so really a lot of the point is to use that framework to discuss alternatives, to discuss different perspectives. And so if you don't have a range of views, that discussion is going to be very narrow. And I think it's really important to have females as a part of that debate.
Thanks. Should we just go down the line?
Thank you. Yeah, absolutely. Couldn't agree more. For a robust discipline, we do need the diversity of thought. My perspective, I guess I can add, because look who I'm sitting next to, is one from an educator's perspective. I guess if we don't have diversity in the economics discipline, then I think in the future we're actually going to have more trouble, because what will happen is that teenagers, adolescents need to see those role models. And at the moment, the absence of those role models is actually an impediment to them taking up the discipline. So couldn't agree more that we need the diversity of thought and the perspectives, but also we need to address it now so that we don't have a greater crisis looming.
Well, my answer is unequivocally yes, which will be, I suppose, not much of a surprise in this context. But in addition to the diversity of thinking, which I think is extremely important, I've rarely found a proposition where one person has the best view. And mostly you can improve it through a good diversity of thinking, and that does, I believe, include gender. But I think there's actually a really fundamental point that, pardon me, that if you don't have some process that knocks down barriers and encourages gender equality, then the chances are you're really not hitting the peaks of merit. And the in some of my background includes as organisation effectiveness and business improvement in a couple of big organisations. And it's a very simple story about missing large chunks of the talent pool if you don't actively make sure that there's access to both women and men in that process.
So I also agree with this proposition, and I guess I like what Alex said about diversity of thought. I think that we have had large numbers of women enter economics. It's certainly true relative to when I studied several decades ago. And I think that that's had quite a big impact on the nature of the discipline. Many people would be surprised at the range of social issues, social and family issues that economists are now engaged in, that they probably wouldn't have been 20, 25 years ago. And I think that's largely because women have brought those issues with them. They have a particular interest in those, and they are now making what would have been sort of side issues kind of core central economic issues worthy of research.
Look, I think inherently there is no biological reason why a man or a woman should be any better or worse at economics. So in some senses, does it matter, you know, to be the controversial one? But in fact, you know, and at the same time, you know, there's no biological reason why a man or a woman should be the unpaid stay-at-home parent, apart from actually men might be advantaged in the sense that they can reach the top shelf and do the dusting that, that my husband doesn't do. But anyway, but just to pick up on Matt's point, I think what is really important here is that why would you cut off 50% of your talent pool? You know, why put yourself in that narrower position? I think that's a really key issue. You know, we're very far from solving the world's economic problems, you know, at this point in time. And if you look at the global financial crisis, I think it would be fair that economists could be put in the sort of collective bucket that said, we got that dead wrong, you know. And I don't remember there being too many women sitting in risk positions on Wall Street before the global financial crisis. You know, I think that there might even be a case why it's very important to have more women in the finance and banking industry for that reason. Because we had, if we'd had a wider pool of talent, You know, would we have had the problems that we've had in the past? I think that's a theme that's been picked up on by some authors recently. John Coates wrote a book called The Arrow Between Dog and Wolf, in which he kind of points out that too much testosterone on dealing room floor is a bad thing, because actually what it does is it tends to exaggerate market movements, particularly bad ones, because testosterone, which he calls the molecule of irrational exuberance, can induce increased optimism about future price changes. So his argument is actually that you could actually do a lot of harm by having men, too many men. So if for no other reason, then there's a good reason to have diversity.
Fantastic. Thanks, Cheryl. Great line. Now I'm going to put up a slide. So this is the backdrop to my question to Lee. This is the number of students studying HSC economics in New South Wales, divided by gender. And you can clearly see we have both a rapidly shrinking pool of economics students and a shrinking share of that pool being female. In your research, Leith, what do you think are some of the key challenges to getting more young women to study economics? And what do we know about what actually works?
Oh, sure. There's so many challenges if you have a look at that graph, right? Look, there's a myriad of things. There's always a myriad of things that are going to affect what makes kids choose subjects. You can see that there was a lot of decline that went on around the early 90s, and we introduced a whole bunch of other subjects then. What's causing that? I think there's things that we're doing in the classroom, what we're teaching and how we're teaching it, and the resources that we're teaching it with that need to be addressed. But I think the larger picture of what's important to this debate is there are other things going on. And even since we introduced those subjects in the early 90s, we still have a decline, and we have that declining share of female students now. And those other aspects are what's really important to that. So those other aspects include the competition that we get from the other subjects, and those are subjects like business studies and legal studies. In business studies at the moment, this 2016, there were 18,200 students. There's 5,200 doing economics. And I can tell you the difference in the subject is dramatic, the content. So there is the competition. You think, well, why are girls choosing business studies and legal studies? Because in legal studies, it's actually a positive weighting towards females. So more girls than boys study legal studies. And I think that a lot of that has to do with the risk-reward payoff that's a little bit altered for female students. Economics is perceived to be a more difficult subject. And I think a lot of the dialogue around economics upholds that. We like to talk in with a lot of jargon. We like to make ourselves sound really intelligent. And also, there's a less clear career path for female students. Legal studies and business studies offer this great, really clear career path. They have a lot of careers days. Their parents and students can see the path to a career for female students. And that's just not there at the moment with economics, so we need to do some work around that. I think that also another factor is the idea that in economics we tend to sell the smaller picture economics. We're selling inflation and unemployment a lot. Inflation and interest rates, sorry.
but unemployment's in our mandate.
Yeah, that is. And the economic prosperity. Yep. But what STEM are doing, and they're doing it really successfully, and they need to do it, and hats off to them, is they're selling a bigger picture. So they're not selling chemical equations, and they're not selling calculus. They're selling space travel and cures for cancer. What we need to be doing in economics is selling environmental sustainability and gender parity and global equality. We can do all of that with our subject. We just need to let people know. which probably leads me to another reason why the decline in those numbers is that there's a general misunderstanding out there in the population about what economics is. And that's translating for young female students into parents who are telling them not to do economics because it's boring. And it's also translating, sadly, into the teaching profession, where a lot of teachers don't understand bigger picture economics. So they're not offering economics at schools. And you see that broadly in some sectors of the education area. So does that answer your question?
That's a fantastic answer. I think it makes it clear we have a problem with young women, but we also have a problem with selling.
Absolutely.
The discipline as a whole, and we are in competition with fields like STEM that are doing a great job to kind of attract the best and brightest.
Absolutely.
So, Deb, I wanted to sort of draw some parallels with the university experience. So the chart I've put up here is the number of students that have enrolled in a degree, either an economics degree or have economics as their major, over the past 10 years. So at university, the proportion of females seems to have sort of stabilised at around 35%. So we're not improving the picture, but we seem to be on a relatively stable path. What do you see we could do to encourage young women that might enrol in an economics degree to either go on and do further study in economics or to take a career in economics?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's good to follow on from what Lisa said. So the first point I want to make is that I've come out of the U.S. system and I have a liberal arts education. And what that means is that I arrived at university having no idea what I was going to do, and the university forced me to do a bunch of stuff. So I've studied advertising and astronomy, child development. I took an entire year of German literature in German, all while doing an economics degree. I had no idea that was what I was going to do. My parents said, go do business administration because then you can get a job. And I got there and I hated it. So in a sense, U.S. universities have an easier task because the kids are kind of wandering around and, you know, you have an opportunity to get them into an economics class and persuade them. The first teaching job I ever had was at a university where in order to graduate, you had to pass economics or logic. It didn't matter what degree you were doing. It could be, it had a great theater department, and all the theater majors had to pass economics or logic. And that's where we recruited majors. It doesn't work like that in Australia. Kids enter with degrees already chosen. So everything that Leith has said about the high school sector, we need to take on board as a discipline, because that really is where we're seeding, you know, what's going to happen going forward. So I checked the numbers. The University of Sydney, our first year majors, we have somewhere around 42% to 45% women. It's higher than yours, so it may be that we're a bit of an outlier, but we're unique in being in a social science faculty. And there's a question in my mind about whether that makes a difference. Our issue is that we lose them kind of along the way. That's true in terms of entering honors. It's not so much about completing. Once we get them in there, they do complete. So we think we have a couple of issues. The good news is I don't think it's a lack of female role models anymore. It's true that women are missing in the higher levels of academia, right? I'm a bit of an outlier. But I've actually asked my students directly, and because they pay no attention to academic rank, they have absolutely no idea that, you know, seeing a full professor who's a woman is a unique thing, right? We have plenty of women in the School of Economics now. The difficulty I think we may have is that we still have some very technical math-oriented subjects in economics, some theory classes, some econometrics, some math classes, and we are teaching those in the same way that they would have been taught 30 years ago. And we are struggling, we think we are struggling to avoid losing women kind of at that point. It's not necessarily a lack of math ability, but the evidence that we have elsewhere is that given equal test scores and equal math ability, girls make different choices about what they choose to study. So to put it bluntly, they may be able to do it, but they just don't want to. And they have other choices that they'd like to make. And so we need to have conversations about Do we need to change the way we're teaching some of those more technical classes and making them more relevant and student-friendly?
Fantastic, thank you. So moving on now to thinking about women in the workforce. Alex, I know the RBA has been very active in trying to improve gender balance within its own ranks. Can you tell us a little bit about what you've been doing and what strategies you think actually work?
Sure. So that's actually a pretty big question, because I think the answer isn't just one magic bullet. So I guess the Reserve Bank of Australia, similarly to the Treasury, similarly to the economics profession broadly, I think we, well, I'll say we all, although I'm probably of the generation that was, we sort of expected that things would just change organically. And I think there was a bit of a realisation maybe, I'll say 5 years ago, that really that sort of organic thing wasn't working and that there were other things preventing that progression just sort of flowing through. And I think one of the things when we sat down and said, well, why isn't this happening? One of the answers was the pipeline. So I think that is very much what Leith and Deborah have been talking about, is if you have an inflow or a recruitment rate of 30%, which is not wildly different to the percentages of students coming out of honours degrees in economics or commerce, well, it's probably a bit high for finance as a general statement. You know, how can you ever hope to have more than 30% anywhere else in your structure? So I guess the first answer to the question is we've put in quite a bit of effort to trying to think about, well, what can we do as a public service institution that really depends quite heavily on the education system to produce the kind of graduates that we want. Well, if we want 50% of the graduates to be females, we have to kind of help the pipeline. So one of the things that we've done is we have instituted a scholarship with the New South Wales Premier's Department, and Leith is, in fact, the first recipient of that. And so that's, I guess, our way of saying, well, maybe it's something about the teaching in schools, because we're not a particularly large institution. So the idea that we could, you know, our staff could get out there and speak to every school in the country, because we also have a strong sense of equality about this, it's impossible. We do speak to schools. We speak to HSC students. We host school groups at bank, but we're trying to be a little bit more proactive about it. So part of it is, well, what can we do to get the teaching to work better at the school level? We've also got a new section within the bank called the Public Access and Education section, and that's to say, well, we produce a lot of economics. We believe that one of the things that gives us credibility as an institution is if people understand what we're doing and why we're doing it. And one of the ways of making sure that the population really gets it is if they're studying economics, and if we can't produce materials that the school system and the university system can use, then we're probably failing a bit. So we're working really hard on making sure that what we produce, obviously there's a whole range of things we don't do in economics, but to the extent that the macroeconomics that we do, the policy work we do around the payment system, for example, can be used, and we can just package it up a bit differently and it's more user-friendly. We're working really hard on that. So that's the pipeline. So then the next question was recruitment. Are we doing our recruitment as effectively as we could? And so something that we realised, again, this is sort of in the 5 to 10 years ago bracket, everyone was having the dawning revelation that it was hard to get the top females, and competition's pretty fierce. So we were competing with the private sector, and if we didn't align our recruitment practices with the private sectors, we were just not getting in fast enough. So we had to change the timing of our recruitment practices. We'll probably talk a bit about unconscious bias at a later point, but we thought, okay, well, how do you reduce unconscious bias? So we've split the task of shortlisting candidates and interviewing candidates. So you're just getting a much broader group of people looking at people to try and assess them. And we've also been working pretty closely with the universities to, you know, there's not that many universities, so we do have the opportunity to say, well, hold on, who's coming out of Sydney University this year, you know? Have you thought about suggesting the Reserve Bank as an excellent place to work? And I guess from our perspective, there's a benefit to the university as well, because we value the honours degree component of the degree. So for the university's perspective, they can say with their hand on their heart, well, actually, there are institutions who value this extra year of training, and there is quite a number of us. So then we've gone through pipeline recruitment. I think it's fair to say that we probably, we've spent quite a lot of time thinking about retention as well. And this is sort of getting to that, well, what have been the barriers that are consciously or unconsciously, meaning that the pipe, you know, we've had a leaky pipeline is effectively where that was going. I think there were probably two things that we've done that I think had quite a big impact. So the first of those was when we did some focus groups, it was pretty clear that although we had really quite fabulous flexibility policies, the perception was that they weren't being applied particularly equally. We heard stories of people saying, well, yeah, the policy's there, but if I ask to work 3 days a week, I'm just going to get knocked back and I don't want to kind of rock the boat. And then the senior people would be going, we've got all these policies. Why aren't people asking for flexible work arrangements? So there was this sort of perception difference between the top and the bottom, the upward and downward looking. So we worked pretty hard on, I guess, making flexibility culturally more acceptable and making sure people felt comfortable using it. And then I don't want to talk too much about unconscious bias, but we actually did unconscious bias training with the senior leaders. That's become a lot more pervasive throughout the system. We do unconscious bias training with everyone who does recruiting now. So, and this is just the idea that there's a tendency, everyone has unconscious biases, everyone has a tendency to make quick judgments based on how people look or how they sound or what their name is or whatever it is. And unconscious bias training, just the act of saying, have you thought about how you've reacted to this person and why you've reacted in that way, can change people's behaviour. So doing unconscious bias training before you go into an interviewing process actually has been proven to change the way people do that process. So have we absolutely removed people's unconscious biases? No, but the first act, I guess, is to make people aware of them and to think as consciously as possible about them to try and remove some of these issues. I mean, there's plenty more, but I don't think I should talk all day on topic.
No, it's fantastic. It's fantastic that the RBA, as well as other government departments, I should say, like Treasury, are taking these kind of issues and policies so seriously.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things I've certainly noticed is we were asking those sorts of questions of ourselves, and you don't have to look very far before you find a lot of other people asking exactly the same questions. So I think my sense is that there's actually been a bit of a cultural change, certainly in the public service. And so maybe this sort of slightly slower than expected organic growth has received a bit of a push in recent times.
Yeah, I think that's right, which probably segues quite nicely to talking about the private sector. Sherelle, do you think there's any sort of unique challenges for female economists in the private sector, and what advice would you give a young woman thinking of starting a career there?
Well, I think, unfortunately, the finance industry sort of, got a bit of a bad reputation here. And, in my time, I've certainly seen some blokey and, frankly, unprofessional behaviour around me. But and recent press, very recent press hasn't helped that at all. But I would say two things. One is it's definitely getting better. I think, as Alex alluded to, things are changing. And they're changing because of good leadership, I think, more than anything. And number two, don't sort of overthink this. Do what you want to do and do it because you're passionate about it. And if that means a role in the private sector, then just go ahead and do it. And, whatever happens and, on the balance of probabilities, you will at some point in your career come across some discriminatory behaviour as a young woman in finance. But so what? You should absolutely call that out, but your output, your skills and your talent, your work ethic and how you do things will completely and utterly outshine any other sort of biases that you experience, I think. But just going back to my first point about the fact that things are changing, I think this is more than just an observation. I think what Australian corporates in general are doing is that they are systematising anti-discrimination. So what do I mean by that? Well, if you happen to have a boss or a work colleague or a client or a colleague, anyone really who's discriminatory, or you just happen to work with a knucklehead who doesn't get it, I think you the chances are that the organisation has put in policies to stop that happening as much as it perhaps had in the past. So in other words, there are rules in place, and anyone who sort of doesn't follow the rules will be caught out by them. I think, you know, my experience is obviously most heavily with ANZ, and ANZ have put in place a lot of policies to really try and level the playing field here. We have been very active in the recruitment process, making sure that's much more gender balanced. All roles at ANZ now are to be considered flexible, all roles. So CEO right through to bank teller. Everyone should have the chance to work flexibly, and it's culturally very much encouraged. I'm a bit of a poster child for this because I work 3 days a week, and I also work from Canberra, which is very unusual for a markets economist to work out of Canberra. And the reason I'm in Canberra is for family reasons. It's for no sort of other reason. It's sometimes inconvenient to my team to have me there, but you know, that's where I am, and it works for the most part. ANZ have also put in place a number of policies to try and bring women financially up to where men are. So in other words, obviously recognising the fact that many women take time out to look after children and their superannuation balances lose out, every woman at ANZ gets a $500 a year top-up to their super account to try and make up for some of that. Equally, women can earn, on their return to work from maternity leave, can earn superannuation, or basically their superannuation is paid for up to 2 years when they return to work after maternity leave. And also there's a number of programs which are particularly aimed at giving women a bit of a lift, I guess, if you like. There's an accelerated banking experiences for women program and a notable women program. Again, all with the attempt of trying to sort of level the playing field and bring women up to where they should be, really, in the industry. I'd say, it's not perfect, but I do think that we're getting a lot better. And as I say, I do think that really good leadership is why that's happening.
Fantastic. Well, it's wonderful to hear about sort of those positive changes. Matt, I'm interested in your view as someone who's been in the profession for quite a while. Do those sort of stories accord with your experiences? Do you think you've seen change in the profession over time?
Yeah, I think I do. Just to set a point of reference, I started work at the Reserve Bank on the 6th of January 1975, which was a very interesting year for a whole bunch of reasons. And I started with a cohort of, I think it must have been about half a dozen or so, of whom about half would have been women. And everybody had a first-class honours degree from some university around Australia. I think relatively quickly, that is within about 3 years, at least one of them had gone off having been attracted by the much higher remuneration then in offer. Remember, this was a time of large financial reform in Australia and lots of opportunities in a rapidly expanding financial sector. But just reflecting on that, to set something, set part of it in context, the decade before, the bank had taken a bit of a pioneering stand on removing the policy that required women when they married to resign, which was just unbelievable. And the people who I think really drove change there were a couple of smart men, as it happened, but I think people who basically valued the points about merit, talent and opportunity that that have been talked about several times. You know, I think it's a mixed scorecard as you look across, you know, essentially the three arms of our profession, academe, public policy and the private sector. I think the latter two, on the whole, seem to be doing better than academe. I think the public sector, quite some time back, set a view that, based on merit, probably going back at least 20 years, I think, but with renewed enthusiasm and more experimentation and a larger drive in recent years. And, you know, while there may be views that, yes, we don't have a head of the Productivity Commission or the Treasury, who are female. We do actually have currently Department of Industry and Innovation, who's a woman, Glenys Beauchamp in Canberra. The head of the Department of Education, the former head of the Department of Finance, Jane Holton, as I recall, was an economist, and the deputy chair of the Productivity Commission, Karen Chester, also. So there's progress being made, and I think that's a very good thing. I think we can see, as you look further down the layers, that picture as well. It's not even across all jurisdictions, but I can speak, I think, for Victoria and also for the Commonwealth, where I think that's pretty much true, and I'm confident that it is elsewhere. I think the private sector has picked up this theme. About 15 years ago, when I was working in what's now Rio Tinto, there was a very strong meritocratic push and some really quite important tools, I think, part of which we've heard, given to really thinking about when you're interested in merit, how do you assess potential more neutrally, which drives you to some techniques that I think on the whole are useful. And they do tend to push against the what I think we find is overused, which is the interview selecting people, and make much greater use of what people have actually done, particularly in opportunities that look more like the sort of work they'd do at the next level. I think my sense is from my academic colleagues that things are a bit slower in the universities and quite variable. We had a heads of department meeting at lunchtime, which really tended to confirm that, I think. But in all those three areas, I think there's plenty of upside to do more. So I'm personally pleased with that we have made, I think, reasonable progress. But there's a lot more, I think, that can be done, and the society is keen to encourage that.
I want to talk a little bit more about academia now, which Matt has mentioned as potentially a point of weakness in this progression. So there was a mention before of the leaky pipeline, and you know, this is your quintessential leaky pipeline. When we look at the gender balance of people at different levels in economics departments, you start with about a third of lecturer, senior lecturer positions being women, down to 25% by the time you get to associate professor, and then just 13% at professor level. We just came back from the Women in Economics retreat, which is a mentoring retreat for junior mid-career women over the last couple of days, and we had a woman there mention that she'd gone through her entire economics degree without having a single female lecturer, which I was, particularly shocked at. So, Deb, I'm interested in your thoughts on this. Also, I would like you to respond. I flicked you a particular study which I came across when I was sort of fossicking around in the literature on this stuff, but it was a study in the United States where they looked at promotion rates across different departments in social science. And they found that if you looked at childless women in psychology or sociology, they tended to get promoted at the same rate as men. So any differentials in promotion rates looked like it was to do with family reasons, whereas in economics, even childless women were promoted more slowly. So the authors were supposing that there was some kind of unconscious bias that existed in economics and not in those other departments. So I'm interested in your thoughts on the leaky pipeline and whether that study sort of accords with your own experience of Australian academia.
Yep. Okay, so just a couple of points to make. I want to echo what Matt has said about progress. We're clearly making progress, right? I mean, I spent the first, I spent the first 12 years of my career as the only woman in any department in which I was employed. Only. It was only when Alison Booth arrived at ANU at some point that I actually had a female colleague. And we're just clearly nowhere near that. So some of what is reflected here is just, you know, it takes a while for the, you know, who you're seeing at full professor is somebody like myself who was hired 25 years ago, right? So you're kind of waiting for these things to kind of play out. The other thing I want to say is you want to be a little bit careful about, well, actually you want to be a lot careful about taking U.S. stuff and applying it to any place else in the world, right? U.S. is a bit of an outlier, and I think I can speak with some expertise on that. The tenure system in the U.S. really matters, okay? So the U.S. has this very hard-style tenure decision. You've got 6 years, you're up or you're out. And it's always had a big impact on women because it hits at exactly the time that you want to have a family. And at the time I was having my kids, you know, I didn't have any leave. I had whatever sick leave I was entitled to. So I was back in the classroom within 6 weeks of having every child I ever had. And fortunately, you know, Australia's never behaved like that. So some of the U.S. numbers you need to just keep in mind, it's a very different sort of system. Having said that, many Australian universities, particularly the top end of town, are moving towards U.S.-style tenure systems. So I'll just put that out there, that we're extending the period over which people are in kind of insecure tenure-track positions, and the decision about whether you get a continuing contract or not is a much harder decision. So I was really happy to take a look at that paper. So the one sort of statistic that kind of stuck away is that economics has the largest gap in promotions, and that's even true relative to science and engineering, and the gap has disappeared in those. And that's when you adjust for productivity. So I have given this exactly, you know, 2 days worth of thought. But I do have one hypothesis about why economics might be different. I chaired the last ERA round, which is the ERA, what is it, Excellence in Research in Australia. It's run by the ARC, and it's meant to evaluate the quality of disciplines across the tertiary sector. And I chaired the panel in economics and business. The thing that's interesting about economics relative to the science-based disciplines is that we are not a citation-based discipline for the purposes of evaluation, okay? And there's reasons for that, because the journals that we publish in don't get fully captured in citation-based measures. And so what that means is the economist sit around, read a bunch of papers, talk about them, and try to form a view about how good somebody is. And that's largely what goes on in universities. It's about, you know, we discuss quality of journals and papers and how important it is and how much to downweight the fact that they published with somebody more important. And it's reputations kind of matter in a way. In science and engineering, they've moved much more to they're measuring stuff. They're measuring citations. They're measuring things. And so those panels that evaluated those disciplines move much quicker, right? I'm not certain of this, but I think that there's something about the fact that what happens to you in economics and the discipline depends a lot on how good people think you are. And we're sort of forming views, and reputations kind of matter, and we debate with each other about how good somebody is. And I think that all has a potential to result in these sort of unconscious biases when we evaluate people's records, particularly if those records are non-standard. And the thing I took away from last year's retreat was the number of women who just, they get there, but they're wandering around while they do it because they're having a few kids and they're following their husbands, and they might have started in some, you know, they didn't necessarily start as academics. And so we do get there, but it tends to be slower, and we have track records that don't look like the standard traditional male track record.
I now wanted to jump to a point that Matt was talking about, and certainly we have had female heads of departments in government, but it remains the fact that in the major kind of economic policy and regulatory institutions, we're yet to have a female lead, and this was a point that Chris Bowen recently made in a speech to the New South Wales Women in Economics Network. Alex, I'd be interested to hear from you what you think the barriers are to women getting to that sort of upper echelon, and how do you see those changing?
So I think I'll echo a few things that I said. I think a huge amount of progress has actually been made, and it's a question of whether it's been as fast as it should have been, and whether the response to the recognition that it's not as fast as it should have been has been appropriate. And I think, you know, and if you look at a lot of the public sector institutions that don't have a female head, there's actually a fairly significant layer just below that. So we've already mentioned the Productivity Commission that's actually had two female deputy heads. Jenny Wilkinson's recently been appointed to the Parliamentary Budget Office, which I'm not sure if it counts as a major economic policy or regulatory institution, but I think it's up there.
It's up there in my mind.
So I don't think we should, I think, you know, that's progress. If I look at the Reserve Bank of Australia, it is true that the governor and the deputy governor are both male, and we've never had a female governor or deputy governor. But two of the five assistant governors are female, and Michelle Bullock has in fact been an assistant governor for some time. So, and I'm, you know, I could probably go through every institution that does count in this group and find a reasonably, you know, so if we take the benchmark not as 50% but as 30%, if that's what we take as the pipeline that we're working with, I think that is the progress is being made. And I think it is just a matter of time, and it might not be such a long time either. But in terms of the things that I think really have slowed things down relative to what they could have is does all come around unconscious bias. And I think it was very interesting what Deb was saying about, and Matt brought it up as well, the definition of merit. So I think something that I've been quite struck with as I've gotten more and more involved in this sort of conversation is if you don't nail down what merit looks like in a very concrete and objective way, you're making it very easy for people to have impressions of other people. It's like, yeah, he's a pretty good bloke. And, you know, I would have been like that when I was his age. So I think a lot of it comes down to, in some sense, forcing the conversation about merit to be, you know, challenging things like, okay, so what has this person done that this other person has not demonstrated? What is the gap here? When you're choosing someone over someone else, make sure that there's a really well-justified explanation that's somewhat objective. And I think that's possibly one of the areas that that the economics profession, or probably any institution, really could always do better on. And I think they're the sorts of, I guess where I'm going here is that we've kind of done the easy stuff, so it's pretty easy to go, okay, flexibility is an issue. And I think flexibility is an issue and has been an issue. Put a policy in place. The policy counts for absolutely nothing until you get cultural change. And I think it was Sherelle making the comment that, you know, institutions that say, okay, well, every job's flexible, and you've got leadership on that and people from the top demonstrating and people from the top reinforcing, that does get cultural change, but you just can't expect it to happen overnight. So I think a degree of patience is warranted, but it's also appropriate to feel a little frustrated at the pace at times and to ask questions and go, what can we do better? And I think, unfortunately, the things that we can do better are things that take, that are a bit harder and take a little bit more time, perhaps.
I think that's right. And I think just give a little plug now for a book by Harvard economist Iris Bonnet called What Works. So she's someone that actually done a lot of research in this area, and it's really about, you know, evidence-based policy to overcome unconscious bias in things like recruitment practices. So I think that's a really excellent source for some of the things we've been talking about. An issue I want to talk about now is one where I think we've had a lot less progress, perhaps. And this is to do with female economists participating in the public economic debate, and specifically the media. So The chart here is one from the Women for Media report, which is a biannual report from the Women's Leadership Institute. And over their survey period, only 9% of people cited as an economist or analyst in the media were female, and that was actually lower than percentage of chairs or CEOs that were women. So I think this is an area where we have a long way to go, and I think the network has a big role to play. Interested to hear from you, Sherelle, as actually a woman that does talk in the media a fair bit. You know, what do you think sits behind these figures? And would you have any advice for women in this room or in the profession more generally about how you actually go about trying to build a media profile?
Well, obviously, as we've been discussing, pipeline is part of the issue, but it's only a very small part of the issues because these figures, as you point out, are actually quite disturbingly low. Having sort of been a journalist and been an economist who talks to the media, I think the media tend to quite like sort of, this sounds a little rough, but perpetuating a cliche, if you like. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if that person looks like an economist, you know, like walks like a duck, quacks like a duck, then, you know, they're probably inclined to put that person in the role of commentator on a particular issue. You know, we see that quite a bit. And I do think that that's actually relevant here. I think, you know, that's been what's been holding the numbers back a little bit. But again, I'd point out that this is definitely changing. I have spoken to, I'd say, at least three or four journalists in just the last, I'd say, last 2 weeks who've said to me that they have been told to seek out female voices in their stories. Like, they have been told they are, if they submit copy which doesn't have a female voice on an issue, they've been told to go back and do it again. It's very encouraging because I do think it is changing. So I would hope that, you know, next time the statistics are taken, that it's not nearly that bad. What advice would I give? I struggle with this a little bit too. I do have some experience in the media, but I could be doing better here too, to be honest. I think, first of all, it's really useful to think about why you want to be in the media, why you need to be in the media in the first place. If it's just because it's sort of for an ego hit or for fun, or even worse, because a journalist just asks you, you know, you're probably not there for the right reasons. If it's because it's a business imperative for you, or you're trying to get your research in front of decision makers' eyes and ears, then it's a very worthwhile thing to do. But you need to be very clear about what you're trying to do. And so, like any other business imperative, I think it's very important to treat it like a business interaction. So, number one, you know, you want to plan it. And that means, you know, right from the get-go, get training. You know, make sure you know how to talk to the media. It's not like any other conversation you're going to have. If you're lucky enough to work for an organization that has a media relations department, be sure to use them because they are professionals in this field and they can give you some great tips. Also, keep in mind that you're probably the best news that's come across their desk all day. So they're going to be delighted to talk to you as someone who has a positive story to tell or even just an interesting story to tell. It doesn't have to be positive. And basically, it's not about what mistakes their organisation has made. You also have to plan for contingencies. You know, have to think about all the different things that you might be asked about, as well as the topic that you were there to chat about, and be prepared with an answer if you don't want to talk about something. You also have to be extremely disciplined in these particular interactions and don't take it lightly at all. One of the worst professional feelings in the world, I imagine, this hasn't happened to me, thank goodness, but I've come very close, is waking up to see yourself quoted on the front page of the Daily Telegraph because you had a slip of the tongue. Yeah, that is not fun. Don't go there. And all that's sort of assuming that you've gotten to the point where you're invited to talk to the media. And that's not always the case. Even if you've done a really interesting paper or you think you've got a really great analytical point, it's newsy, it doesn't mean to say journalists are going to come sort of knocking on your door, picking up your phone number. So you do have to do quite a bit of self-promotion here. And, that can be uncomfortable. But it's worthwhile getting to know journalists, you know, go chat to them, sit down, work out who you can trust on the record, off the record. Know who your audience is. In other words, which journalists are going to get you to your audience. for me, it's really about being seen as, you know, obviously trying to improve the reputation of my employer, about being a trusted advisor so that our client, ANZ's clients will see me as a sort of a trusted economist out there. And equally, ANZ staff, our internal stakeholders, very important here. You know, ANZ is a very big organisation with a lot of people, and it's very important for me to build my reputation with the staff as well, because they're the ones that, you know, are consumers of our research. So do get out there and sort of ruthlessly and unashamedly promote yourself. You know, tweet, get involved in the conversation, make yourself available for conversations with journalists. You know, every time you speak, these are just little tips, but every time you speak on your cover sheet, make sure it's got your Twitter handle on it. Make sure it's got your email address. If you've got to make it obvious where people can find you, get your phone number on there. You know, hand your business card out. If you really genuinely have a reason to be out there in the media, then you do have to promote yourself. You know, ask for favors. Ask other people to retweet you. I do this all the time. You know, it's not comfortable, but it's kind of what you have to do. And back yourself. You know, you've got something really interesting to say, so get out there and say it. And another thing to know is, that just going back to the point I made in the beginning, this is a time where the journalists are really looking for female talent, for want of a better term, in their stories. You know, the ball's in your court. It really is. And so, you know, get out there and channel your inner Serena Williams.
Fantastic advice. And I would echo, I think, that the culture of news is changing. And certainly at the network, I'm constantly asked to recommend females to various reporters that are actually looking for female economists to comment on their story. And sometimes I hand them Cheryl's way and sometimes other people's way. But to make that process a bit more systematic, something that we hope to be doing in the next couple of months is doing a media register. So we're encouraging females that are keen to speak in the media or are keen to speak at conferences to get on the register. That will be a sort of searchable database that journalists can go to when they want a labour economist or they want a market economist that they can then go and call up. So stay tuned for some further information about that in the next couple of months if you're part of the Economic Society and the Women in Economics Network. That perhaps leads me, just before we move it open for questions, for a quick question for Leith, because you mentioned role models. Obviously, females in the media is kind of one source of role models. How important do you think it is for getting more young people to study economics to have those role models out there?
I think, well, the answer is very, really. Why, I guess, is the question. In my mind, why it's so important that adolescents see role models in our discipline is, I think the neuroscience looks at the adolescent mind, the brain, and says, even though it comes in a package that we perceive to be almost grown, the brain's not there, it's not fully cooked. And if you live with adolescents, you'll know exactly what I mean. And that has implications for what we do, and it has implications for our discipline, I believe. I think that, and it's the reason why we have those terrifying pictures on cigarette packaging. What happens with the adolescent brain at that stage is that they can't actually see something that they don't know exists. So that's why we show them the horrible picture on the cigarette packet, so that they think, oh, that's a thing. Maybe I might not do that. Maybe I might not do that. And the same with the terrifying commercials on TV with speeding. And if we want to use that information in a positive way, then what we have to do is show them what economics can do and show them women doing great economics and show them women doing a huge spectrum of economics. So not just talking about finance, but we want female professional economists from all fields in the media more. And then that way it becomes a thing that they can aspire to. How best to do that? I think, well, I personally believe that our discipline hasn't done a great job collaborating between sectors, and we have to all own up to owning a share in what's going on. And I think to enable that, if we were to collaborate between education and the tertiary sector, the secondary sector, private enterprise and government, then we will be able to do that more effectively. So that's supporting organisations, obviously, like the WEN, to do that. But if we can all, from all of our different sectors, come into that with the mind that we all own this problem so we can all have a share in helping fix it.
Fantastic. Thank you. I am keen to talk a bit more about the network, but I want to make sure that we have time for questions. So I think perhaps we'll open up for questions now. I see lots of hands up, which is fantastic. Can I just ask that we try and keep to the topic of hand, of female participation in economics? Nikki, would you like to start?
You, is it on? Oh, yeah. You all talked about the progress that's been made, and we certainly can see some of that. But the most alarming statistic is that number of kids who are actually studying at school level. And if you, I mean, obviously not everybody needs to study at school to go on necessarily to university, but doesn't that actually tell us that there's a huge risk that the small progress or the whatever progress we have made to date is actually really strategically at risk, and that we, if we don't change this very quickly, we actually are risking now, you know, going backwards at those senior levels? And what do we need to do about it, apart from trying to attract people by getting more people in the media and out there?
Sorry,
we've all got an opinion.
Look, I think there are two things being brought together here, both of which are important. I think there's a question about why is economics much less attractive to both young, both genders as kids. I mean, if you look at the first slide, can we get, shuffle back to the first slide? Okay. All right. Look, what I suspect you see is a combination of more competition in other subjects that will attract kids, but also I think the tail end of an incredibly interesting decade and a half in public policy, which itself I think was a very eloquent argument for how important and valuable economics can be. So I think that's part of the question, is, I suspect, is how we motivate kids to study economics in the first place. And I suspect how we teach economics is an important part of that, as well as what people understand about that. On the other side... Sure. Well, probably because I think there's a tendency not to motivate the teaching of economics in terms of the problems over the years that we've sought to analyse and understand and make sense of, but rather in terms of the tools. So that the point being that start with, well, why is this an interesting subject? Well, did you know? Go back to studying panics and manias and what happened in the 17th century in Holland about tulips. And you can then look and think about what's been happening pretty much since about 2005. So that's one bit of it, I think. I should also declare that I know there's at least two people on this panel who actually didn't study economics at school. I was one, I did it, and I know Deb was much the same.
No, I have an economics degree. It just included astronomy.
Not at high school, though.
Oh, that's true. At high school...
Sorry, this is...
High school. No, that's correct, yeah. Right? Most, unless things have changed since I was a student, right? U.S. high schools do not teach economics. It's not a high school topic, right? You first are introduced to it in the university.
Sorry, if I can just... even if we presume, if we presume that not everyone needs to study economics at high school, so not everyone needs to do HSE economics, what we need to do then is work out a way that we can get an understanding of economics to the broader population. And there's a list. I've got a list if you want to see a list. But I think that's what we need to do. So what we need to do is educate not just the school kids to do HSE economics, but educate the general population. And let's be honest, then they're actually going to be able to vote properly as well. So, you know, there's wins all over the place.
I've just been at a Year 8 subject selection night, and one of the things I thought was really interesting was how the different subjects sold themselves. So this is not economics, although commerce was one of the options. And one of the things I thought was really interesting about the design and technology guys, my daughter went and had a look at what they were doing, and she was inclined towards it anyway, but she came away going, do you know what's really great about this? it's going to help my problem-solving skills, and that's really important for my future life. And I was thinking, well, actually, that's not what I see when I look at design and technology. But I think going back to this, what is it about economics that we don't, or how are we not marketing it? I think it's what are the problems that we're solving, and they are really interesting. And I think it's also the fact that you build a whole set of skills that are extremely interesting for answering traditional economics questions, if you like. So that I'm a macroeconomist, so I do answer questions about inflation and unemployment. But as Deb pointed out, the framework of economics has broadened out spectacularly over the last, sort of since it started, really. It's just kept expanding. So being able to tell kids, well, this is a framework for helping you solve problems and develop a whole range of skills that will be great if you want to be an economist or a policymaker who's doing something to do policy evaluation, or, you know, the list goes on. The guy who started Kaggle, which is a data science place, has got experience at Treasury and the Reserve Bank. So there's just so many examples of where the training and the thought process has led to something super exciting and modern, not just sort of old crinkly macroeconomics. And I think I wouldn't phrase it so much in terms of role models, but just getting it out there, where this could take you. Because parents, speaking as a parent, they're going to look at, well, what can you do with that? And you need to be able to answer that question or give them an answer so that they can be enthusiastic as well. So it's not just the kids, it's the parents.
Can I just add a point to that, Danielle? I think we have to make it cool, you know? I think, you know, we're talking about adolescence here. We have to be cool. And we're not really very good at that, let's face it. I think, you know, every now and again I do something a bit quirky and my boss sort of indulges me on this. But, you know, recently we did a paper, well, not recently, it was 2 years ago, but I'm looking at updating it. Just there's a little paper on the economic benefits of marriage equality and the fact that, you know, if you get all this spending on weddings, you add $1 billion to the economy. I've never had so much media interest in anything I've done in my entire life. It took me 3 days and the interest was massive. So I think we maybe just need to think outside the box a little bit, if for no other reason than to market our profession and give it a little bit of a cool edge every now and again.
Be cool, everyone. Tina.
Can you hear me? Okay. There's been a lot of parallels between the STEM and the economics in this debate, but I'm going to give you a kind of a provocative statement, and I think this is my opinion too. You know, there's always been women have been underrepresented in STEM for a long, long time, and suddenly when there was a shortage in people in STEM, especially mathematics and engineering, they were like, oh, we need gender equity because that is the only way we can increase, you know, the supply of engineers, actually. So I kind of think that people turn their head to equity just when they don't have enough men. I think that in economics there are enough economists, and that's why we don't get the same attention and the same support from government as STEM is doing. So there's a little bit of a challenge in that sense. And, you know, when it's a kind of a private initiative, whereas STEM is getting funding and the SAGE initiative in Australia is currently happening. The Athena Swan started in the UK, and 10 years after the Athena Swan, suddenly they opened up to social sciences. So how are we going to handle that? Because we clearly are not getting the same attention and the same support as STEM. Do you have any ideas of how to do that?
No, I'm not. So I'm just going to be honest here and say I'm actually a lot less concerned about barriers, right, than I am. I'm just coming to the perspective that, you know, it's just possible men and women are sort of interested in different things. And that, you know, selling economics is a problem solving and making people aware of the breadth of it, I'm all in favor of. But I don't know that I see huge barriers. Right, I think it really is at this point about choice, and it's kind of an interesting thing because, I'm sort of struck by the fact that as we have actively worked to reduce gender discrimination, generally, Okay, we have not ended up with equality in occupations. And some of these occupational swings are pretty interesting. So, I guess maybe as a room of economists, you're going to know this, but, you know, law is a female occupation now. So is accounting. And I want to tell you that at the University of Sydney, in the veterinary science school, just pick a number in your head, I'll tell you in a minute, what proportion do you think of vet students are women? Nearly 90%. So clearly what we need to do is put vet next to engineering, right? It's just possible that men and women have different interests, and that some of what we're seeing is kind of preference based, and that, you know, as a discipline, what we need to be doing is maybe worrying, maybe not quite so much about the sort of barriers or you know, at least the sort of unconscious barriers that used to be there, and thinking a little bit about advertising and making people aware of kind of what we do. At the University of Sydney, first year economics, 45% are women. It's kind of hard to argue that we've got a problem with the gender balance coming in the door.
Can I just ask you a question, Deb? So this is so to the extent that you start with 45% women and then not ending up doing honours, for example, the real question is, where do they go? And what is it that they are being attracted by that economics isn't providing a sufficient... I've just asked a question when it's really audience time, but...
I don't completely know the answer to that. It is something that we are discussing. So what I think is happening, in part, is that a lot of these women are doing things like they're doing dual degrees, right? They're doing arts law, right? So they're doing economics and law, or they're doing, you know, some other degree which gives them a bit of breadth. We are concerned about making sure that women are entering honors, so we know that's a pressure point, so we run some special events where we try to target women. We do think that once they enter honors, we're hanging on to them, so we're not sort of drumming them out. But the pressure points for us seems to be the technical subjects. Right. If this is about straight up math theory, you know, metrics, they just seem to be less interested in that.
Can I just jump in on Tina's question quickly as well? I mean, my experience dealing with government is it's the squeaky wheels that get attention and get money. And I think STEM has been a squeaky wheel. They've been really, really effective at doing what they do. And now they're seeing the benefit of that in terms of these very comprehensive programs that they're able to offer to address gender balance. So I think it's up to us as a discipline if we genuinely think this is a problem and a concern, and we think that funding is one way in which we can address it, to be out there advocating for that. And I'm certainly very much pro doing that as part of the network. I think we had some... We've got...
So related to the recruitment of women and also the exposure of media that we talked about, I read some research a while ago saying that women interview very different to men, and that men tend to be more confident, and when they are asked about a topic or something that they don't do, they kind of are eager to, I can do it, and you know, they are just proactive about it, while women may be more honest or tell about their limitation, I've never done it, and I have no experience on that, so kind of showing some kind of weakness. So my question is it a problem that we actually don't know how to sell ourselves, not only the subject of economics, but women don't know how to sell ourselves? When we see in our CV a gap because we have been raising kids or caring for someone, why don't we sell it as, you know, I've been managing kids and managing a household, and I'm an expert in time management, and I can assure you that we all agree that it's better to be at work than working at home, so that's a hard work. Why don't we promoted that way. So is that naturally intrinsic to be a difference between men and women that we don't know how to sell each other? Or is it cultural that we don't have that confidence and we are weak in that sense?
I'm sure that matters to a degree, and that probably factors into the kind of unconscious bias that Alex was talking about. The thing about that, though, is I spend a lot of time thinking about the gender wage gap and this business about, you know, negotiation and women not wanting to compete and having different risk attitudes and not being prepared to ask for, you know, higher salaries. It actually isn't the thing that's driving the gender wage gap. Now, that's not to say that it doesn't matter or that it's not part of what the story is, but it's actually very difficult to kind of quantify that and to turn that into something that, you know, is the kind of measure of gender equality that we're typically used to looking at.
I think also this really goes to the point of it's something Catherine Fox has been writing a lot recently, which is, you know, do you have to fix women? Is there actually anything wrong with women? Yeah. You know, actually maybe that sort of honesty and that considered judgment is the better outcome, you know, the better result, the better quality to have in an employee. I don't know the answer to that, and people see it in different ways, but I do think that's a great concept. You know, why are we trying to fix women to be more like men? I don't see why. It doesn't make sense. It doesn't necessarily lead to better outcomes.
Do you want to add to that, Alex?
Sorry. So this issue, I mean, it's kind of a well-established kind of fact, I guess, that people have done research on this confidence gap. So men will, on average, so that there's obviously differences in the distribution, will state things more confidently and as if there's no real, on the one hand, on the other hand, where it seems women are generally more likely to have an opinion but be more interested in talking about the confidence intervals around that opinion. And I think the thing, the conclusion I've come to, and this goes a little bit to, you know, should women fix themselves or should women become more like men or should the culture change? I think it's pretty clear that culture change would be optimal, but you have to be realistic that that's going to take some time. And then the question is, well, are you learning to be more like a man or are you just developing a new skill? Because let's face it, there are situations, so we all work in economics, right? So there are situations where it's entirely inappropriate to state something categorically if you don't know it's true. There are many situations, like I have staff, and if I ask them a question, I would much prefer to know the nuanced issues around the point than to be told this is the absolute truth and then discover it's not. So there are some situations where that's appropriate, and there are other situations, so we were talking about the media before. You know, media don't have time to listen to a long, convoluted explanation about all the ins and outs of your theoretical research. They want the elevator pitch. So I think the way I think about this is that there's a range of skills you need for a range of different situations, and developing that range and knowing what context to use them in is just about you becoming better at a whole range of different things. So I think in some ways I'm agreeing that sometimes it's just about marketing things the right way and learning when to be that person rather than the more considered person.
Mm-hmm. We've got one down here.
Hi, my name is Tobias Beckman. I'm from the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet. I wanted to pick up on something that Alex said a little bit before, on how really the flexibility in policy really accounts for nothing until you get cultural change. And that obviously you can't expect things to change overnight, but Alex, you said you need to be asking what things can be done better. So I was interested in your opinions on what can be done better in order to actually achieve that cultural change. That, so if you're looking, I guess, 10, 20 years into the future and you see a difference of opinion, a difference of situation of the balance of female and males. How did we get there in that point?
So I think the answer, I think I've provided some of the answers to that. I think it's partly about thinking carefully about what merit looks like and trying to be as objective as possible about these things and doing our best to have conscious thought rather than let the, I can't remember which way, is it type one or type two, just the short circuit responses guide our decision making. And that's hard work. I think another aspect of this discussion, and I don't know if this will be controversial, I see this whole question as being about having choice. And so for a long time, you know, we'll predating Matthew's experience in the workforce, women really didn't have very much of a choice at all. And over time, women have had increasing choices about what they can do for a living and how they work. And flexibility has been a really big part of that. And I think when we talk about flexibility, the other side of that coin that we don't talk about so much, but I think it's becoming an increasingly important part of the conversation, is that maybe men haven't actually had as many choices as we're used to thinking about them as having. So they were the breadwinners, and maybe there was a whole lot of men in the 1960s that would have been perfectly happy if they didn't have the whole social context to stay at home and look after their kids. Or maybe they would have liked to work part-time. And I think we're certainly moving to a world now where we're seeing that as the flip side. So, you know, some men want to hang it. My husband has been the primary carer of our daughter, and I think she's a much better adjusted person for that experience. You know, and that's a conversation between myself and him. He works from home and he likes that flexibility, and I'm much happier in a, you know, structured environment. That works for us. But just the idea that men should be able to ask for the flexibility to look after kids, to look after elderly parents, to do other things. So it's all about everybody having the options available to them. And I think things like today's panel and having those conversations is an important part of making the change.
I'd like to add to that. One of us said earlier, it may have been you, Alex, who said that leadership is really important. In my experience and having a fairly diverse career, including seeing deep cultural change in organisations, you cannot underestimate the importance of consistent leadership at every level in an organisation and embedding that at every level in the organisation. Those things don't happen by chance, and the organisations that have done that, with which I'm most familiar, have taken probably 15 or even 20 years to get that right. And even then, there's always more to do. The importance of leadership here is not only the demonstration of the values, but it's also being clear about the sorts of behaviours and respect and expectations you have about everybody in the workplace. And because in my view, the underlying issue is one of merit, and really it doesn't matter whether you're a man or a woman or any particular background. You need to be able to see through some of the differences to understand who the individual is and to make sure the environment is such that it's actually driving those expectations. That translates into systems, symbols, behaviours, structures and so on, and it is a much more methodical approach than I think it's sometimes given credit, but it takes that, and one of the most important elements in this, I think, is leadership.
We've got time for one final question.
Michael Heath from Bloomberg. I worry a bit about going to stereotypes with this, but Cheryl mentioned the testosterone among men on the trading floor, and someone else mentioned risk management and that sort of thing. Do women bring something different, perhaps in terms of managing risk or you know, vulnerabilities or whatever, in economics, just because of their innate nature, I guess? I mean, is that something that's ever explored or looked at that? A person who's not as gung-ho or doesn't tend to inflate the importance of things or is a bit more balanced about it, I guess things we'd think of as more feminine attributes, is actually an advantage in the field?
So I just got done writing a handbook chapter. The title, well, the topic was addressing what's the evidence on the question of whether or not the gender wage gap is biological, right? So I read a bunch of science, right? And my astronomy didn't prepare me for this, I have to tell you. We are starting to get out of neuroscience and genoeconomics and genetics. The more we sort of understand about the brain and physiological responses, the more we understand that there are gender-based differences to the way that men and women think and behave, and that it's related to the things that make us biologically female or male. Okay, so there is evidence that women have different physiological reactions to risk, and you might imagine a sort of evolutionary story for why that might be true. But on the whole, right, the gender gap is actually sort of surprisingly small in physiological functioning. That's the first point. The second point is that it's nearly impossible to link these sorts of differences in biological functioning, either related to testosterone or estrogen or whatever it is, to a labor market deficit. The thing about the gender wage gap is that it's persistent. It exists in every society in which we measure wages. It's nearly impossible to find an institutional arrangement or a society or a time period where it is not true that women earn less in the labor market. And these sorts of biological differences about attitudes to risk or, you know, the way women deal with competition or the way we communicate, there are advantages in some circumstances and disadvantages in others. But on average, you have no compelling story that leads you to think that this sort of testosterone or these biological differences translate into a deficit on average that is that persistent. It does, in my mind, lead me to expect that you would find men and women in different types of work, right? So, I mean, to just give you a very basic example, men are 6 times as likely as women to be colorblind. And that's going to rule out certain kinds of occupations. And the kinds of risk attitudes, right, that lead men to deal with risk differently are going to be an advantage in perhaps finance occupations or certain kinds of occupations, but not others. So there, I think you would conclude that there might be a biological basis to at least some of the occupational differences that we see, but you can't explain the overall gender gap. Sorry?
You wouldn't do better with a financial risk department
attached to women. I think it depends. So I'm going to go out on a limb here because I'm going to pick up on something that Sherelle said. I believe that I have seen a documentary on Iceland through the global financial crisis. And Iceland turns out to be one place where the banking sector wasn't a disaster. And for some reason, because it's small, I guess, it happened to be dominated by women. And so there is a theory that suggests that sort of risk attitude isn't always an advantage, right?
I think, yeah, and I guess to be clear, I mean, this is the work of one person, and I just think it's relevant to what we're talking about. But, I also note that, there was some criticism of his work as well, you know. So I think... you know, that's a hard one. It's very difficult. I don't know that you can generalize to that extent, but certainly it's sort of an interesting point. It does bear some thinking about.
I mean, I haven't seen anything specifically on risk management, but there is certainly a whole suite of evidence that when you're making decisions, having a more diverse group and those different attitudes is helpful. So, for example, having more diverse boards, we see that firms tend to get higher returns. So there's certainly some evidence that you want to have kind of different
personality types and different thinking processes within broader groups.
Mm. And I think, you know, the James Sirowiecki book, Wisdom of the Crowds, is pertinent here as well. You know, if you've got a lot of people, different people with different backgrounds with no association with each other, you do tend to get better outcomes. So, you know, whatever that makeup may be, differences tend to lead to better decision making.
Fantastic. We actually got to 5 o'clock, and I thought we'd only go for an hour. We've gone for an hour and a half. If I could just indulge me for 1 minute, so I can very quickly talk about the Women in Economics Network. I think Leonora's handed out some flyers, so I'll skip over this. I just want to talk a little bit about the things that we've done this year. We've only been around since March. We've had a series of really fabulous events, including our launch events around the country that were attended by over 650 people. We've had some amazing guest speakers, including Lucy Ellis, Jess Irvine, Chris Bowen, the OECD Chief Economist, Catherine Mann, Harvard Professor Jenny Klugman. We are advocating for women in the profession. As I said, I'm constantly referring media outlets to speak to women, and do stay tuned for the launch of the Media Register. We hosted the first all-female economic panel at the National Press Club earlier this year, which was a response to the 2017 budget, and we've been invited back to do that as an annual event. And we're doing a lot on the sort of pipeline issues that we've talked about today, spearheaded by Leith, also with the RBA, working out ways in which we can try and sell economics as a profession to young people, and particularly young women. So something we're doing, for example, is to produce a video featuring real economists in different and interesting parts of the profession talking about what they do. So that's something that teachers can then play to their students in class, so they can actually get a sense of really just how diverse and exciting a career in economics can be. So you join the network by becoming a member of the Economic Society. Just tick the box when you sign up. It's free to join with your Economic Society membership. Men very much welcome and encouraged to join and to come along to our events as well. So if you could all please join me in thanking our speakers today for what I think was a really interesting and well-informed discussion.